hotels.
Beyonce may not quit on herself, but will Nikki Haley? It's Super Tuesday, folks, here on the Maggie Dawn Show. You're listening all across the Civic Media Radio Network. You want to join the conversation in this last hour, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-75-CIVIC. Yeah, big Super Tuesday going down. We got a whole mess of states going to the ballots. Nikki Haley pulled out, I don't know if it matters, a little bit of an upset question mark in D.C. over the weekend, defeating Trump in Washington, D.C.'s primary. Yeah, that's the Beltway, folks, and the Beltway ain't what the rest of America is. Basically, it becomes almost statistical certainty after today if Trump does what everybody expects him to do in these primaries. You got two of the biggest elector vote getters in the nominating contest in Texas and California, both voting today. Both of those primaries in the GOP caucus, both of those primaries are winner-take-all and closed primaries. What do I mean by that? Whoever gets the most votes takes all the delegates. They don't proportionately split the delegates. So even if you say, if Nikki Haley pulls down 40, 43, 45, 46, 47% of the votes, she gets zero delegates. Closed primaries, many argue, are part of the problem because it often forces candidates to effectively campaign in the primary season on the most extreme end of their party spectrum so that you can turn out the base. All you need to do is nose your opponent. You take down all those delegates. California, 169 delegates. Texas, 161. Again, winner take all, and they're closed primaries. What that means is if you're an independent, if you're not registered as a Republican, you can't vote in those primaries. It locks out a whole bunch of people who may be middle-of-the-road voters, swing voters, independent voters, who may have a very, very strong distaste for Trump, and again, makes it less likely that the less partisan candidate in a primary might win. Again, a lot of scholars point to these closed winner-take-all primaries as exactly part of the political problem in the United States. I happen to agree with them. Also voting today, also with closed winner-take-all primaries, Oklahoma and Alabama. Anybody wondering what's going to happen in those states? I'm not. Nikki Haley's not going to win those. Other states voting that might be a little interesting to keep your eye on. Vermont and Virginia. Why do I say this? Well, Vermont, Trump only took down, I think, like 32%. He was beat in Vermont in the 2016 primary. Virginia and Vermont, they have demographics that tend, at least pockets of voting districts in Vermont and Virginia, where you've got college-educated, higher-income voters that are registered Republicans. In those districts, Nikki Haley tends to do better. No big shock there, right? In fact, though she lost South Carolina, she was able to win in a few districts where those demographics prevailed. At least one that I can think of off the top of my head outside Charlotte, South Carolina. So keep your eye on those districts because Nikki Haley is effectively the canary in the coal mine for Trump's weak spots. You follow me, right? So there's a lot that's happening in this primary, even though because of states like Texas and Florida and the way that the GOP in those states operates that have these closed winner-take-all primaries that don't help any of us elect candidates that are more moderate, which for... My opinion, I've never buried the lead on this one, folks. My opinion has always been moderate candidates tend to better represent Americans and lead to consistent progress. Legislatures that actually get things done. Presidents that don't do wildly stupid, crazy things. Like extorting an ally to gather dirt on your political opponent. or inciting an insurrection. More on that in a moment, right? So again, though this may seem like a relatively boring Super Tuesday, in a nominating contest for the party that's out of the presidential power, usually this Super Tuesday is a big deal. Usually you got at least two or three people still in the mix. No. Ron DeSantis, he's gone. He's worried about busting college partiers at Daytona Beach. I'm sure it's a drag if you move to Daytona Beach. But again, do you not know where you're moving? I've digressed.
No, I think it's important. I was mad when I heard about that, the spring break stuff. Like,
right.
How dare you? That's your part of that's your economy, right? That's another day.
Another but day, still. Another topic. Ralph from Milwaukee, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you, my friend?
Are you there?
I am here, Ralph. Go ahead.
Taking you back to your last segment just before the news, I only was able to catch your guest for about the last 3 minutes of the conversation, and I wanted to ask, what was making that office available for the position she's running for? What's happening to the incumbent?
Yeah, so great question, Ralph. Scott Mansky, who's been Milwaukee County's comptroller first, before it became elected, he held that position by appointment, and then it became elected, I forget how many years ago, but I think about maybe three election cycles ago, so roughly 12 years ago. Scott Mansky's retiring. So that is now an open seat in Milwaukee County government. Did you have another question for Liz, Ralph? I can attempt to provide you some of that background, even though Liz isn't here.
May I ask, is Dave Cullen still involved with county government?
Yes, he is, Ralph. Great question. I'm actually going to cover Dave Cullen as well. Dave Cullen is currently the Milwaukee County Treasurer. Now, let's just take a moment here because Ralph is raising a really interesting point about government. Many Wisconsinites, no matter where you're from in the state, might recall this bill that was introduced by Republicans here in state government to eliminate the state treasurer's office. And a lot of liberals opposed that. I actually supported it. Why? I don't think treasurer's offices serve any function in a modern government anymore. They used to be very much like cutting the checks and making sure that things worked correctly. But now all of that is digitized. And Dave Cullen is a longtime, long-serving public servant. He's a gem of a guy. I couldn't, you know, say any more kind words about Dave. This isn't a criticism about Dave at all. It's a criticism about treasurer's offices, whether at the city of Milwaukee, whether at Milwaukee County, whether at the state. They just don't. Those functions could be consolidated into the comptroller's office or the budget office, which also exist. In other words, in government, if I follow through on my promise to be a fiduciary in government, I should be looking for things that really aren't all that efficient anymore, that might be done better, or combined function areas to reduce the footprint of government, not in the face of any policy question. Smaller isn't always better, nor is bigger always better when it comes to government. But in this case, I do think treasurer's office have become largely superfluous, especially in a district or governmental jurisdiction that has an elected comptroller. Why do you have an elected treasurer, too? Oh, and if you're wondering about the treasurers, and wait a minute, this really isn't all that essential anymore, how much do these guys get paid? Well, the Milwaukee County treasurer is looking for a 20% raise. So is the Milwaukee County clerk and the Milwaukee County Register of Deeds. Bruce Murphy, in Urban Milwaukee Today, go check the article out, makes the case that all three of these positions in county government, but also in other governmental jurisdictions, aren't needed anymore, that they're antiquated, that those services are already being covered effectively by other departments, or they could simply be made appointed offices. And Bruce Murphy is criticizing the fact that the Milwaukee County government, Milwaukee County Board, is considering giving all three of these antiquated, potentially unnecessary jobs 20% raises. They already make $90,000 a year. So, Ralph, if you're still there and you're still with us, what do you think, Ralph? Should these three offices get these 20% raises? They're making 90 G's a year doing stuff that other functions of government could probably cover.
Well, until you explained it, I was ignorant of the details of how county government or state government works regarding that position, and I don't disagree with you.
Yeah, I think we could spend a whole lot of time on this, Ralph, and maybe Anya and I will hit that up this week and really take a poll, because I think liberals and Democrats went to defend the treasurer's office within state government because of the fact that the state legislature had been so basically irrational about blocking Governor Evers' appointees, and they didn't want to have another function within state government, either as an appointed position that the GOP gerrymandered legislature could block or consolidated within some other governmental function. But that argument ends at the partisanship of it. To me, partisanship as a reason for doing or not doing something within government doesn't really stand on its own. The question should always be, what's most efficient? What's most effective? Who can do this best? How should we structure those to ensure that government is doing everything it can to be sure that the taxpayer dollar goes as far as it possibly should? So I will put that on our topic list for this week, Ralph. Thanks so much for the call. Keep listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. If you've got more questions about the Milwaukee County Comptroller, the Register of Deeds, Treasurer's Offices, Chief Legal Officers and the like, I'm your gal, because I certainly know just a wee bit about that. Liz is going to come back and join us on April 1st. On April 2nd, we'll have the City of Milwaukee Comptroller candidate Bill Davidson in on the Maggie Dawn Show. You're going to always hear from me, folks, this desire to actually talk about some of these nerdy elements of government, not just at the federal and state level, but local levels as well. And no matter where you live in the state, there will always be an analogy to what I'm talking about, my Milwaukee frame of reference. If you have a particular local official or interest area that you have, do not ever be afraid to give Anya and I a call at 855-75-CIVIC and say, Maggie, something's going on in my local government. Let's take a look at it together, and we will do that work together. Now, when I come back, we are going to dive into the Supreme Court Colorado decision. You're not going to want to miss that, because I'm going to drop some tidbits other folks may have missed, because that's my job. Break it down with you and for you. So coming up next, the Colorado Supreme Court decision leaving Trump on the ballot here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Join us. 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842.
I'm a strawberry soda, raise my lashes to heaven. Stars in my hair running like a waterfall. Clouds in the white, so far as we saw it all.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. Join us. What do you think about the Supreme Court's Colorado decision leaving Trump on the ballot? Right decision? Wrong decision? I made some predictions on my show about this case many moons ago. We'll get to those in just a minute, because I love it when I'm right. I know you all do too. But before we get into the meat and potatoes of that, I just thought, given that it's Super Tuesday, we have to listen to a little bit from the top two GOP candidates. Why don't we take a listen? This is Nikki Haley, I believe, last night leading into Super Tuesday. Here's what she had to say.
They worry about wars breaking out, and all of that is under an umbrella of anger and division. And then we wonder why there's so much anxiety, stress, and depression. This younger generation deserves to know what normal feels like. And that's what we're trying to do, is say, let's go forward in a way that they can feel that, not the chaos of Joe Biden and the fact that, you know, he's allowing millions of illegal immigrants to come in without anybody stopping them, not with the chaos of Donald Trump, where he continues to call names and criticize the military and side with dictators. We just need to bring normal back to America so that we can let our kids see the American dream again. And that's
what
I'm trying to do.
Republican voters do seem to be breaking in favor of Donald Trump so far. Can you turn that narrative around at this point?
Well, I think if you look in all the early states, while Donald Trump won, he didn't get 40% of the vote. If you look in Michigan, Donald Trump's been campaigning there for 8 years. I campaigned there for 2 days and we got 30% of the vote. If you look at the size of the rallies, these are not people who are anti-Trump. These are people who are pro-America. And they want to see an America that they can be proud of. They want to see an America that does have the American dream. And they don't like the America that Joe Biden and Donald Trump have given them. And so we're giving them an option. We're giving them a choice. They're not going anywhere. They very much want to make sure their voices are heard. And they very much don't want to be pushed into what they have to do or how they have to do it, because they believe that America is better than this.
So you've said repeatedly that you wouldn't be Donald Trump's vice president. Is there anything that would change your mind about that?
No. I mean, I think I've made it very clear I'm not running for vice president. I think I've made it clear this isn't about a political future. If it was, I would have been out a long time ago. This is about the fact that we have a country to save. This is about the fact that we can't continue to be living like this. It's not normal. This isn't helpful to our kids. We are better than this. This is about preventing war. This is about securing our borders. This is about getting our kids reading again. This is about making sure that taxpayers have more money and not keep forking it over to government. We've got to start writing this.
There's a lot there. You think she had a little bit of coffee?
She was passionate. This is in Massachusetts. Yeah.
Strong
Boston coffee, maybe? Is that?
You go to the Dunkin' Donuts. You turn right at the gas station. You go down the line. Then it'll go,
I don't
Dunkin'.
Want one red eye. I got two eyes. Two red eyes, please.
Two red eyes,
I can't
please.
Do a Boston accent. Huh?
I can't if I thought about it. Yeah. Extemporaneous, I end up sounding hackneyed. But yeah, she had a little Dunkin'. But in all seriousness, the chaos of Joe Biden and her thing that she cites is the border. I want to make this really clear. Joe Biden cannot close the border. We do not have the infrastructure to hold everyone, according to Republican Supreme Court Justice lackey Samuel Alito. He also doesn't have the executive power to do that in many of the ways that would be required to actually increase security at the border. Greg Abbott, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, has effectively sued the federal government to stop federal border patrol agents from patrolling the border because he would rather engage in political performance art, or what I term as performative politics. Performative politics being on this show not doing anything because it's actually helpful or will make things better, but simply because you can and you have the power to do it, and it will raise your personal political profile. So, yeah, Joe Biden can't close the border, Nikki, and she knows that. Quit lying about it. The problem with our immigration system, the problem with our border, the problems that have created increasing, exploding numbers of migrants, not just on our continent, but all across Western Europe, those weren't created by Joe Biden, our broken system. And Joe Biden has put a bill in front of Republicans that is the most aggressive immigration bill that Republicans have ever seen in 20 years. And Donald Trump won't let the House of Representatives, controlled by Mike Johnson, vote on the darn thing. So, Nikki, don't talk to me about that. Don't make a false analogy between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the chaos maker. He's the reason we're here. That is the chaos agent. And let's hear what the chaos agent had to say about Super Tuesday, because it's equally batty.
Thank you very much. I want to start by thanking the Supreme Court for its unanimous decision today. It was a very important decision. We're very well crafted. And I think it will go a long way toward bringing our country together, which our country needs. And they worked long, they worked hard, and frankly, they worked very quickly on something that will be spoken about 100 years from now and 200 years from now, extremely important. Essentially, you cannot take somebody out of a race because an opponent would like to have it that way. And it has nothing to do with the fact that it's the leading candidate, whether it was the leading candidate or a candidate that was well down on the totem pole, you cannot take somebody out of a race. The voters can take the person out of the race very quickly, but a court shouldn't be doing that, and the Supreme Court saw that very well. And I really do believe that will be a unifying factor, because while most states were thrilled to have me, there were some that didn't, and they didn't want that for political reasons. They didn't want that because of poll numbers, because the poll numbers are very good. We're beating President Biden in almost every poll.
Blah, 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 blah. First of all, maybe try not thanking the Supreme Court that's supposed to be apolitical and following the law. Ew, ick, disgusting. Second of all, no one was proposing to remove you from the ballot simply because you're the leading GOP candidate against Joe Biden. I don't remember any time in American history, Mr. Trump, when the Democrats or Republicans were like, hey, let's file a court case because we don't like this person. I don't remember any time in American history, Mr. Trump, when Democrats or Republicans were like, hey, let's file a lawsuit to pull this person off the ballot because they're winning. No, Mr. Trump. Colorado removed you from the ballot because you engaged in an insurrection. And when I predicted the outcome of this case on my show back in December, what I said to you was this. I hope what the Supreme Court should do, what I hope and what they need to do is have a unanimous 9-0 decision that places Donald Trump, returns him to the ballot in Colorado. And I said that that should be the outcome, not just on the law, which I will get to after the bottom of the hour, because again, tidbits in there, nuggets. People are going to act like this was simple. It wasn't. Not just because of the law, but because I do not want the fringe lunatic MAGA right, the chaos agents that stormed the Capitol on January 6th, to have grounds to do so again. Our democracy is teetering. We are on a breaking point. We cannot withstand arguments that Trump was somehow denied his fair shot. It was interesting because somewhere in that cut, Anya, he said something about letting the voters decide. And well, sir, they did in 2020. They in fact did in 2016, where you did not win the popular vote. I mean, the guy's nonsense coming out of his mouth. When we get back after these quick messages, we're going to go to the phones and I'm going to dig deep into the Supreme Court decision. And you're going to hear things that you won't hear on any other program, TV or radio. Here on the Maggie Dawn Show, join us, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842.
Know that I loved you so bad, I let you treat me like that. I was your willing accomplice, honey. I watched as you fled the scene.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-75-CIVIC. Did the Supreme Court get the Colorado decision right? That's what I want to know from you. I think they did, but... So again, to recap my predictions from back in December, one, I said they will conclude, of course, that he needs to remain on the ballot. By extension, that is also in Maine and Colorado. One, he's got to remain on the ballot. Two, I said, I certainly hope, and boy, I hope they're listening to me, needs to be a, quote, unanimous decision, 9-0. They basically did that with a couple of caveats. I will get to those in a minute. And thirdly, this is the third part, and this is the part that I'm really mad about. Not really mad, but somewhat concerned. The Supreme Court didn't address whether or not the guy actually engaged in insurrection. Now, this is in keeping with the long-standing principle of judicial restraint. In other words, the highest court in the land will only decide that portion of the case that it needs to decide in order to dispense with the case. However, that is in the ordinary course of affairs. Is this the ordinary course of affairs? It is not. Unifying the country, that's what Donald Trump was blathering about before we went and took a few messages. Well, this is great. Thank you to the Supreme Court. No president should be thanking the Supreme Court. They don't work for you, sir. They're not supposed to be picking sides. They have to decide the matter before it. But again, this isn't going to unify the country. It simply leaves them on the ballot, and it leaves open the question that could unify the country, or at least could tamp down some of the lying that continues from the far right, could at least potentially disavow some of the woefully misguided people who have been lied to with such fervor, such commitment, up and down Republican leadership by all of these elected officials who swear an oath to the Constitution, lied to repeatedly over and over again, that January 6th wasn't an insurrection, that these people were just visitors, or that it was some FBI conspiracy, or that it was anything but Donald Trump's fault. The Supreme Court could have unified us. They didn't. That's my first criticism. That was what I said back in December. What they need to do is tell the American people that indeed Donald Trump engaged in insurrection, but the way that that has to be meted out, that responsibility, that accountability for that has to be meted out, is in the ballot box. And that by depriving him access to the ballot, as decided by one individual state, isn't the way federalism is supposed to work, not for the highest office in the land, that indeed would be chaos producing. Because flip it on its head. Now, granted, we don't have Democrats inciting a revolution and trying to overthrow democracy. We have policy disagreements, right? Conservatives, I don't like Biden's border policy, or I don't like Biden's tax policy, or whatever. That's not inciting or engaging in insurrection. But despite the factual predicate, if you took a state that is so totally beholden to Donald Trump, totally owned by the MAGA fringe of what used to be the GOP, I can't even call it that anymore because the principles of conservatism are missing from the MAGA party. It's not the Republican Party. It's not the GOP. It's the MAGA Party. It is the party of Donald Trump. It ain't a conservative party anymore. I don't know what that is. But in a state that is completely controlled, where state elections officials and county clerks are all MAGA fringe, where the Supreme Court in a state is MAGA fringe, think Alabama, because I'm going to talk about the Alabama Supreme Court and the wing nuts that are on it next Monday. You take a state like that, how hard is it to imagine, that in their supplication to Donald Trump that they wouldn't also simply say, well, we'll help Donald Trump, we'll remove Joe Biden from the ballot on completely bogus factual grounds. That's the chaos that the Supreme Court points to. So in a nutshell, what the Supreme Court's ruling was that states cannot enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. That's basically what the ruling was in a nutshell. I don't disagree with that. However, there are some seriously problematic elements with that, such as the fact that the 14th Amendment is self-executing, meaning it doesn't need enabling legislation from Congress. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court said. In other words, I think there needs to be other enforcement mechanisms that don't necessarily require congressional action. Congressional action could certainly make it plain who could enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But there may be other things that the federal government or federal officers could do related to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And in fact, here's tidbit one. I promised you tidbits that no one else is probably going to point out. Here's tidbit one. Guess how the decision broke down? Four justices criticized the five justice majority who went on to say not only that states can't enforce Section 3 without something more, without some kind of federal action, they went on to say that basically, only Congress can decide, and it has to legislate. And the four effectively dissenting justices, though they don't call it that, that will be my next tidbit. You don't want to miss that second tidbit because it's a doozy. The four dissenting justices said the majority didn't need to go on and specify exactly how Section 3 must be implemented or effectuated. And that breakdown, 5-4, guess what? It was dudes and ladies. It broke. Women were the four dissenters, including Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Jackson, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. And it was the five dudes They were like, well, let me tell you a thing or two about how this Section 3 is going to work and Congress has to do it. Which leads to the question, does anybody think this Congress is going to get that done? I mean, hell no. So tidbit one, I think it's really fascinating that the four justices that were urging restraint, that were saying, and they wrote separately, Justice Coney Barrett wrote separately, and then Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson wrote together in a separate, quote, concurrence. I think it's fascinating and does speak to why it's so important to have diversity in all places, in all offices, of all government functions of power, in all boardrooms. Because here it was the women that urged restraint. Don't decide what needn't be decided to dispose of the case. A concept as old as time within American jurisprudence called judicial restraint. It was the women that urged that in this decision. And it was the five arch-conservative men, one of whom hopelessly conflicted with respect to anything that has to do with Donald Trump, the most corrupted Supreme Court justice in modern American history, Clarence Thomas, saying, no, 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 we'll always go that extra step. We'll go that step too far. And this decision, the majority decision from the five men, mostly, is littered with references to the text of the Constitution and history and tradition. And this always gets my back up. For the reasons that I noted at the top of my show, our Constitution is a living, breathing document. It is insanity. It is stupidity. It is head in the sand, ostrich-style legal interpretation to say, well, let's be sure we do it like we've always done it. Because then bring back the three-fifths compromise. Take my right to vote away from me. I wouldn't be on the radio anymore. I mean, right? Come on. Of course, our laws and our interpretation of our founding documents has to evolve in some way, shape, or form. Does that make history or tradition irrelevant? No, it makes it context. But not always determinative context. There's a reverence. There's a subservience. There's an obsession. I would call it a predilection, if you will, of these five men on the Supreme Court to bow at the altar of tradition and history, and to close their eyes to the real and practical impacts of their decision on everyday Americans. They are the ivory tower. The ivory tower isn't in universities as much as it is enshrined in the northeast quadrant of Washington, D.C., where the Supreme Court sits. That is the ivory tower, a marble tower where cameras aren't even allowed in the courtroom. Where journalists aren't allowed to bring recording devices or their phones with them. And I'll point this out. Throughout the decision, there's these little phrases, these little rhetorical devices that are employed by the five male majority of the court. Things like, there is little reason to think that the elections and electors clauses, which authorize states to conduct and regulate elections, which could have been a basis to argue that Colorado could very well do exactly what it did. But the five male majority says there's little reason to think that these clauses implicitly authorize states to enforce Section 3, blah, 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 blah. Anytime you see something like that in a legal decision, I call the hedging language. There's little reason. Well, that doesn't mean zero reason. There's just little reason that these clauses implicitly, well, maybe they do implicitly. They use words like implausible. But is it really? Because you're entertaining the argument, aren't you? It might be argued on page 11. It might be argued. Oh, yes. Well, it might be. And in fact, that was what was argued. Hedging language all over the place. And there's a bunch of arguments that I think really are simply beside the point. Such as this: any congressional legislation enforcing Section 3 must, like the Enforcement Act of 1870 and Section 2383, reflect congruence and proportionality between preventing or remedying insurrectionist conduct and the means adopted to that end. Okay, legal gobbledygook there. Please don't turn the dial. What does that mean? Oh, well, only Congress can be entrusted to proportionately respond to allegedly insurrectionist conduct. Is basically what they're saying. So what? That has no bearing on whether or not Colorado can make that determination. There's only Congress can determine. Well, why not Colorado? You get my drift here? And proportionality, I didn't see that word written anywhere in Section 3 because it doesn't exist in Section 3. In fact, Section 3 dictates the remedy. So what the heck are they talking about? Congruence and proportionality between preventing or remedying that conduct. No. Section 3 is the remedy. You don't get to be a federal officer again. And it goes on and on. So when we come back in this last segment of this special Maggie Dawn, it feels like every episode is special because there's so much happening.
I agree. They're all special.
In the Trump universe. We're going to take some calls. And I'm going to give you tidbit number two about this decision that you're going to probably hear only here and first on the Maggie Dawn Show. When we come back after these important messages, tidbit number two on the Supreme Court's Colorado decision, join us, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. Mama, that's moving up and I'm moving out. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the last segment of the Maggie Dawn Show on Tuesday, Super Tuesday, March 5th. All right, here's my second tidbit for you. We've been talking about the Supreme Court's decision saying that Donald Trump must remain on Colorado's ballot. They concluded in a nutshell that Congress must legislate to operationalize Section 3 of Article 14, despite the fact that all other portions of Article 14 of the Constitution adopted after the Civil War are self-executing, meaning does not require legislation. And the five justices that decided that were all the men. The women said you could have simply concluded that Colorado itself, without further action from the federal government, cannot remove Donald Trump from the ballot, because then you could have all kinds of states with all sorts of different processes and evidentiary standards and burdens of proof deciding and coming up with inconsistent decisions on this, the most important election in our country as to a presidency. They said the court went too far. That was going to be a dissent, folks. That is tidbit number two. This was not going to be a, quote, unanimous decision. They had called that an actual dissent in the drafts. How do we know this? Because the Supreme Court forgot to scrub the metadata when it released its opinion. Yes, folks, you are hearing it here on the Maggie Dawn Show. The Supreme Court forgot to do what I was doing back as a baby lawyer in 2003, which was scrub metadata. What is metadata? It's all the little quicks and quirks and zeros and ones that are actually buried in a Word document or Lotus Notes or whatever the heck you use to produce your opinion if you are the Supreme Court. You scrub it. There's a function and it takes all that back, like who edited what, when, and where, and why. All that's buried. That's the metadata. They didn't scrub it. And so at the top where it says per curiam, which means unanimous, it used to say, you can see this in the metadata. I actually, if you're watching the Maggie Dawn Show, I have it. I'm showing you the metadata. It actually said distant.
I was trying to show it off on the live stream.
Oh, show it off. Show it off.
Sorry,
on the live
stream. I was trying to give it some jazz hands.
Jazz hands.
And I realized it looked like I was telling you had 25 minutes left.
Yes, long time to go. No, it said concurring and listed the justices, and then it said dissenting. Again, metadata. This is why you want to watch me on Facebook. Let me see if I can show it. Concurring in part. There it is. Concurring in part. And then it says dissenting. Dissenting in part right there. So that's tidbit number two. It wasn't a unanimous decision. And so Trump's, oh, it's unifying. No, sir, it's not unifying. They were dissenting because the five men on the court went a bridge too far. Now, a couple of other interesting elements of this case will go to the phones. I promise I'll try to get everybody in. Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Justice Jackson begin what was their dissent with a quote from Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in the most divisive decision handed down yet to date by this Supreme Court, and that was the Dobbs decision, removing the right to select health care from women across the country. And they quoted from that most divisive case and from the Chief Justice's concurring opinion, because the Chief Justice in that case also criticized the MAGA extreme right five justices who wrote in Dobbs and said exactly what is the problem with the decision in the Colorado case. And that is, if it is not necessary to decide more to dispose of a case, then it is necessary not to decide more. None of us legal nerds missed that jab, right? You got Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson saying, hey, here are your words, conservative majority, in the Dobbs case, where you upended 50 years of women's equality in one fell swoop. You don't want to miss that little bit. And you don't want to miss this little tidbit, too. Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson also point this out, that the majority did not say, did not deal with, did not address what happens if someone is prosecuted criminally by an oath-breaking insurrectionist. You know, like if Donald Trump gets reelected and then, you know, takes over the DOJ and sicks the DOJ and the FBI on everybody who's ever opposed him, like me, and locks me up and tries to prosecute me for treason. Can I object and say, hey, he's an oath-breaking insurrectionist and shouldn't be able to prosecute me? Or the prosecutor that he's chosen if they were in the Capitol storming, destroying property on January 6th? Because I think that's kind of an important question. Don't you? And here's what the decision, neither the dissenters nor the majority say anything about. Can Congress on January 6, 2025 refuse to certify the election if Donald Trump is elected? Because that would be a congressional action. That certainly would seem to be what the framers intended. So think about that. I'm going to say it again. Could Congress on January 6, 2025, if Donald Trump is elected, refuse to seat Donald Trump? Bill from Oconomowoc, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you, my friend?
Great show, Maggie. A question. In your legal background, would you say this is the worst decision that happened from the Supreme Court to lower the integrity, the honesty, the political diplomacy, everything for America? Do you think this just takes it to a new low? What's your thought?
I think it's just another downward trajectory step. I think Dobbs was extraordinarily poorly reasoned. Why do I harp on justices calling to tradition and history? Because that is a circular argument. If our rights are only those rights that were defined back in the late 1700s, then again, we're all screwed. It's a tautology, a circular argument that perpetuates the past into the future ad nauseum. Dobbs was terrible. The affirmative action decision was terrible, divorced from reality. And what I talked about last week, the Supreme Court's decision to grant cert in Trump's immunity case is certainly even worse. That's it for me today. I'll be back tomorrow. If I didn't get you on the lines, I'll get you tomorrow. Mark and Steven, I see you. Thanks for listening, everybody. Listen, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Tears going, follow away, follow away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames.